Well, hello, superstars, and welcome back to another episode of Word Up with Danny Katz. Today I am joined by Steven Ravenstog. Steven first landed on my radar at Music in Sky. I did not have the pleasure of meeting him there, but at the event, he and his partner Melissa gave this mind-blowing talk called Getting Off the Emotional Roller Coaster, which had me digging deeper into Steven's work. And he's working in the personal development space, but in this very nuanced, masterful way in terms of helping people see the gaps between what they know they need to do and actually doing those things. He and Melissa have a program called Awareness School. He does one-on-one coaching. They have a few other offerings, and I was super excited to have him on the podcast to dive into his path, how he got into working with people in this capacity, some of the tools and strategies that he is sharing with his clients and his students. It was a juicy conversation. I'm kind of in awe of what he's doing. It's speaking to a little bit of a chasm in my own personal development, where for years, if not longer, I've been wanting someone to speak to what is this space in which I have not yet gotten in the habit of executing what I know is best for me. I know I'm not alone in having that experience. So this was a juicy conversation. I know you're gonna love it. Before we dive in, I'm reminding you to click that subscribe button, to like, to share, to comment, to sign up for my newsletter at dannykatz.com. And now I recommend buckling up and preparing to enjoy my conversation with Steven Ravenstog. And we're just going to dive in. Steven.
It's always awkward. Yeah.
I'm sorry. It is. But we're going to move through that. How are you today? How's your Monday going?
I'm great. Great. I got my workout in before this meeting, which I'm very happy about, because now I'm fully here and not thinking about what I've got to do afterwards. So I feel very good.
I did as well. What was your workout today?
I'm doing kettlebell sport, which is sort of like time sets of kettlebell lifting. And it's something I've always been known about, but recently got into. And I have a guy who's doing my programming for me, which is, you know, I've been kind of a self-guided exercise person for most of my life. But there's something wonderful about having someone make the program for you, because one, you don't have to think about it. Two, you get a surprise every week. You get to look and say, what am I doing this week? You know?
Yeah, it keeps it fresh. I've seen your kettlebell videos on your Instagram, and I haven't done them myself, but I'm always worried about everyone's lower back, because it seems like a lot of swinging. And I'm like, I know there's got to be a strategy to it, but it kind of freaks me out when I watch it.
Yeah. Did you see that? That's so funny, because someone else commented on one and asked me about why I do a certain thing. And they're like, I'm concerned about the lower back, or I would be, you know? And so that's a whole conversation. I don't know how deep you want to get into sort of the biomechanics of rounded back lifting and all that. But some of the rules that apply to the general population, sedentary people, you know, people who have not trained the low back, don't necessarily apply to every version of that person that they could be. So that if you're properly trained, and that really, in my experience, most low back problems, and I mean, just sort of chronic discomfort and also acute injury is as a result of a failure to properly train the back. Yep. And my understanding of what proper back training is not, you know, be like this and bend forward necessarily. It's training the spine through the ranges of motion, which include flexion, which include bending it and loading it in sort of an intelligent way. And so I had back problems like as an unathletic child, and I have zero back issues now. So.
Oh, I love hearing that. I'm always attuned to like trends and paradigm shifts. So I just noticed that it's interesting that this kettlebell thing is coming up at the same time as knees over toes is coming up, which is also smashing that fiction that it's not good for us to go over our toes. So just kind of, I mean, I've always been an athlete, so I nerd out on the body stuff, but that is not why I invited you on the podcast today. I saw your talk with your lovely partner, Melissa, at Music in Sky, which was about getting off the emotional roller coaster. And it totally blew my mind. And amidst, you know, multiple days of awesome programming, I can say unequivocally, it was my absolute favorite talk. It set off so many ahas for me. So I was so excited to get you on. I've been, you know, doing my best to sniff you out online. You're a man of mystery. Even your website has no about Stephen section. So I'm just so curious about your path, and how you got here.
Right. I think that's called being a bad marketer. I don't, that's not mysterious. It's just not liking back office work. Oh gosh, I don't know. I was born and I looked around and haven't stopped yet. I mean, that's pretty much been it. Just noticing people and noticing things and noticing that there are, I don't know, a lot of differences between what is expressly articulated and subtly implied. And kind of picking that stuff out. So I've just been kind of paying attention my whole life, you know, to little things and interpersonal interactions. And oh, when you say this, that's not always what you mean. Sometimes you mean this and this and all that. And then I just kind of went about my life with that little program running in the background. Went to college because that's what one does. And then I went to chiropractic school. Went to kind of by accident, I ended up going to chiropractic school and was really into the idea and the sort of philosophy of chiropractic in the general sense of being like, you know, natural health and thing. And everyone was very fit, which I liked. By the time I completed chiropractic school, I realized it was not for me. And I mean, the practice element of it, I didn't enjoy the type of interactions that a person did in a clinical and setting like that, because it was a lot of hellos, which is my least favorite part of a conversation, is that initial hello, how you doing? And then I like to get into the depths of it. And that's literally the only thing that you can't do in most offices anyway. So I remember right before I graduated, I was like, I don't want to do this. And acknowledging that to myself resulted in an instantaneous relief of a tremendous amount of tension and pressure in myself that I did not even realize was there. And that sort of was like, isn't that interesting? And then I started to say, what if that's not a one-off thing? What if there's a whole bunch of tension inside that I don't know about? And I had a strange experience too, that when I realized I didn't have to do it, and I said, oh, like this, there's this picture of my grandmother popped into my head. And my grandmother was not like a bossy lady, really. She did not say, Stephen, you need to do this and you need to do that. But there were a couple of times when she said, well, you need to decide what you want to do in life. And so I thought it was very interesting that an image of her popped up in the most fleeting way possible when I realized I don't have to do this. And what was interesting was that I had a tremendous amount of resistance to acknowledging that I did not want to do what I had just invested tremendous amounts of time and energy and money into getting ready to do. There was a tremendous amount of resistance to doing it. But the moment that I did it, I was 100% free. I didn't care about any of the consequences of it. I was 100% happy with having made that decision. And so that sort of was the segue into what you'd call personal growth, spiritual growth stuff, as a professional endeavor. But it was also a turning point in my life personally, because I was like, I bet a lot of people have a lot of this tension that they're going to be really happy they let go of, if only they can find someone who can maybe persuade them to persuade themselves to let it go. If that makes sense.
It totally makes sense, and I think it speaks to, I mean, the programming around just like sticking to the course and how much courage it takes to invest so much time and energy in something only to decide that we're not going to take that path, and also to not judge that as a failure, right? To just be like, oh, how beautiful that I had this experience, so I could now be at this place where I know this isn't the path to me. I don't have to, the path for me. I don't have to second guess it, you know? And I think there's something in like the non-linear, like maybe less efficient ways of moving that don't get a lot of validity in a sort of like productivity-based, you know, bottom line brass tacks culture. Were you raised in a functional, emotionally intelligent household with parents who knew what they were doing?
Oh gosh. Well, so now we've gotten to the point of what would you call this? Of autobiographical conversation that involves describing other people, you know, who still exist, which is fine. But in my, I would say no. Not from a complaining perspective. I don't know, and I don't even necessarily know exactly what one means when they use that terminology. You know, I mean, I get an idea, but I'm also aware that I could be misinterpreting some of what you're saying. But no, I did not. I'd say that I learned as much by observing things that didn't work as by observing things that did. At various points in my life, I was very fortunate to encounter people who seemed to have little bits and pieces of understanding about what's going on or about how to do life. And I benefited immensely from the contrast, you know, that a lot of people do things in a certain way. And so I did not, what I would definitely say is that I've always been a little bit at odds with the people in my immediate environment. I never felt as if I really belonged there, and the relationships were not necessarily unpleasant, but that there was a certain degree of incompatibility, if that makes sense, and occasional conflict. And so I definitely didn't come from a background of people who were like, oh, follow your path and pay attention to what's going on, and everything will be fine. None of that.
And to be clear, I wasn't asking as a means of like gossiping about your family. It was just wondering if you came by these things naturally, because I definitely notice a difference between people who were raised with emotional intelligence, recognizing feelings, versus those of us who were raised by feral wolves and, figuring it out on our own piecemeal in
Yeah.
adulthood.
I think I was really fortunate, and if there could be an environment that's like a petri dish for cultivating awareness, I would say that probably my home life was that, because it was in many regards what you could call dysfunctional, in different ways, or at least some patterns arose that were dysfunctional when you combine the way things were with me. You know what I mean? Because I'm a little bit of an unusual person, I guess, to begin with. But it wasn't so intense and it wasn't so horrifying that I was constantly in a state of all-out survival mode. So that there was a constant friction and a constant tension. But it was also a situation where I had the wherewithal to sort of connect dots. And so in that sense, I feel fairly fortunate. Do you know what I'm saying? To have come from an environment that was, let's say, manageably unpleasant under often, because it gave me the impetus, but it also gave me the space.
And may I ask what you're referencing when that made you unusual?
I mean, I don't know. I just look at myself, and then I look at other people, and I look at what other people's experiences of me seem to be, and I just get the sense that, I'm a little weird, a little different. That what goes that what it's like to be me is like is not necessarily within the normal range of what it's like to be the people that I'm around is like, or maybe I describe it differently or something. I've always, I mean, ask Eurasimos, but that I just, yeah, I get the sense that I'm a little different. I remember one time my father said, he looked at me and he said something to the effect of, the wheels are always turning. And I didn't understand what he meant at that time, but constantly sort of thinking about things and wondering. And I think other people maybe have the capacity to do that, but for whatever reason, they become numb to it, or they don't follow the thread. I've always been really interested in following the thread, and also I really like to open loops. And if the loop is open, I put a little pin in it and always make a point of coming back to it. Like for instance, in an interpersonal interaction with someone that's important to me, that I'm going, I mean, someone I'm going to be interacting with on a repeating basis. If something happens that I don't understand, I don't usually just kind of go, whatever. I'll put a pin in that and I'll say, well, if that comes up again, I'm going to pay attention and see if I can gather more information on that point. And I think that sometimes I get the sense that people feel, I think they probably start with some basic assumption or sense they need to be other than they are, right? Something wrong with me. I need to be, I'm not as far along. I don't have enough money. I don't have a partner. I'm not nice enough to the partner I have, whatever. And so you start with a basic assumption. There's something about me that needs to be other than it is right now. And then that creates an internal environment of being in a real hurry, being kind of frantic, where it's very easy to maybe notice things that pique your curiosity, but then you go, I don't have time for that. I'm in a deficit. I've got to move. And I haven't dealt with that. I've never really been that way. And so when things capture my interest, I always make a point of going, no, I have to at least put that on the agenda to come back to. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, and it speaks to, I mean, it's such an overused term, mindfulness, but like, did you have a meditation practice growing up? Did you cultivate that type of attention? Did that type of attention come naturally for you?
I didn't start meditating until I was like in chiropractic school. I got into the Bill Harris CenterPoint Research Institute's got the Holosync meditation CDs. Fantastic. Love it. I would describe it as life-changing. It was a supercharging of everything of my ability to pay attention, I would say, and to create an environment inside that was, I'd say, conducive to insight. I never did anything like that growing up. I didn't, I mean, I remember, I spent some time with a Bavarian lady who was a very devout Catholic. And so she got me, and she basically had me sort of pray the rosary for her on her behalf or something. And I got into doing that. And I was kind of, I noticed that I could get into altered states with that. And I was kind of interested in just the ability, just by through this as repetition, as you're going around this thing and you're saying these different little mantras or whatever. But that's as close as I ever got. And that wasn't like something that characterized my whole childhood. So I was pretty much just wandered around and looking.
Interesting. And so you complete chiropractic school, you land on this isn't for me, And then how did you ultimately move into the personal development realm?
Well, it was actually kind of, it was a beautiful confluence because I had been reading Tim Ferriss's The 4-Hour Workweek, which, the only thing I really remember from that was this idea that like you can make money doing stuff online. That was pretty much it. It was the kind of like you don't have to have a normal job. That was the big eye opener there. And at the same time, I had been studying as a result of taking up the Holosync. Bill had a bunch of courses that he offered that kind of go along with and supplement the meditation CDs. And so I had been taking those, and I was so interested in what he was talking about, and I loved to apply it in my own life. And I started to think, gosh, what if I could share this with other people? Like, what if this was the thing that I could do? Because I was very interested in how useful it was, but also in how it seemed to me that people could learn about this stuff and avoid getting the benefits from it. They could have an intellectual understanding that didn't kind of penetrate into the automatic behavior generating centers of their mind, right? And I had a, it's kind of funny. So when you're in chiropractic school, you do something, it's a little bit like residency. It's called, they call it a PEAK program. And it's where you kind of go out into an office and start interacting with patients. And probably 70% of the stuff I did was mindset related with the patients. I did a little bit of kind of chiropractic stuff, but then I really loved hosting workshops about the mind and about like, okay, your doctor's telling you to exercise and you're not doing it. Isn't that interesting to you? Do you want to, but you want to do it, but you're not doing it. How do you think that happens? And kind of helping people to understand that behavior doesn't just happen, that results in most instances don't just happen, that one's own inclination to do a thing or to not do a thing, although it seems to be just happening if it's being generated outside of awareness, that there's often processes that are going on inside that are contributing to or creating that inclination or lack of inclination, motivation or lack of motivation. And if you can bring that process within your awareness, then you can, it becomes something that you're doing, and it becomes then something that you can do differently so that you can make it not only that you do the exercise, but that you experience a natural inclination to do that, which will feel good to have done. And so that was sort of my foray into this, was that I, it was a wonderful opportunity to start interacting with these lovely sort of mostly older women, that go to the chiropractic office, and helping them to figure out ways to get them to do the things that they say they wanted to do.
What you just said to me is everything. For someone who's been in the personal development world for decades, I work with clients myself. I have my own stuff that I'm still moving through. Like, that's everything. There's so much that we know, but then there's that breakdown between implementing and actually affecting the change. I love that you mentioned Tim Ferriss, and I'll come back to that in a moment. But like, it seems like this is your secret sauce. So how did you hone in on whatever those breakdowns were between knowledge and behavior, and then, cultivate these tools to help people actually be able to affect change for themselves?
I think the first big thing was being very comfortable not knowing, so that when I go into the room with Peggy, right, and Peggy is not doing something that she ought to be doing, or not should doing something she shouldn't be doing, sit down and not feel as if I need to be the expert in the room. Like, I would sit down and just simply say, yes, isn't this interesting? Do you know why you don't do this? Do you know why you do this? I don't either. Like, I wonder if we can find that out. And so that environment of curiosity and not knowing, which I kind of got started with then, but really supercharged for me when I read the very early neuro-linguistic programming books. Specifically, there's one called Frogs into Princes. There's one called Reframing, and there's one called Transformations, like Transformations, but it's like a trance, like a hypnotic trance. And these were seminar transcripts of Richard Bandler and John Grinder doing work with people. And I don't even know how to describe it. It wasn't a technique that I got from them, but there was an attitude there that captured, I think, the essence of a very effective approach to creating personal change. I mean, I remember this was like 2016. So this is like 2 years after I graduated chiropractic school. I was reading those books, and I felt my mind changing as I read those books. And as I started just to sort of unconsciously model Bandler and Grindler, and I using some of their speech patterns, right? One of them was, things like, as far as I can tell, saying, as far as I can tell after I say something, meaning sort of implied in that, right? Based on the information I have right now, it seems like this is probably true. And, not saying it as a language police thing, but is actually building an attitude that goes, as far as I can tell, this is what seems to be happening right now. And there's an unspoken, and this could be completely wrong, and a whole bunch of other things could be going on too. And so that comfort with not knowing, I'm not an expert. I don't know anything. And when I can free myself of that just onerous burden to have it figured out, all of a sudden my entire mind, not just my expert role player mind, gets to come onto the scene, and then we can do something productive. And then there's just a flow and a glide to the interaction. And so then that opens up the door for all of the information gathering strategies, all of the, okay, well, how does this person motivate themselves? What do they say to themselves? How do they go about thinking about doing something for 6 months and not doing it? Then you can gather that information, but it's really hard to do that if some part of you is uncomfortable with or not okay with being in a state called not knowing without experiencing anxiety. Because then you can be in the state of not knowing and you can experience curiosity and you can become a pertinent, relevant information gathering vacuum. You know what I'm saying? Instead of a person who's afraid of getting caught unprepared, get caught up in class and you don't have the answer, then you become a person whose pupils dilate and you just begin sucking in all the information that the client is offering you. And they're offering you tons about how exactly they go about being the way that they're paying you to help them change from. You know what I mean?
Totally. So from my perspective, being the unknown is a very feminine quality.
Okay.
Being comfortable with the unknown and the not knowingness, is that something that you, again, that comes easy to you, comfortable in the unknown, in those more mystery spaces?
I never thought about it as feminine, but it doesn't seem wrong to me. It seems I have no I have no opinion on whether it's that or not. It's an interesting way of thinking about it. Yeah, I mean, I'm comfortable with it because, I don't know. I mean, it's the way I think I'm comfortable with it because it doesn't matter if I'm comfortable with it or not. If I'm uncomfortable with not knowing, I still don't know. I
Right.
mean, so why be uncomfortable if the discomfort's not going to resolve the situation? And I think, probably that came about as a result of a certain number of personal experiences with the futility of resisting not knowing and of creating that discomfort. And I just noticed it didn't help. And so I said, okay, I can do this thing called, I need to know this. I mean, and the other thing too is how do I create discomfort? Because it's not just I lack discomfort with regard to not knowing. If I'm experiencing discomfort in a situation of uncertainty, I've got to be creating that discomfort. It's not just it doesn't just come. I have to say, impose upon myself an obligation to know, or I have to be super identified with, I'm an expert, I know this. I have to make not knowing a problem in order to be uncomfortable with it. And so one of the things for me is, what is it? What are the assumptions in my mind right now that cause the situation that I am sort of conceptualizing as not knowing? Why is this an experientially uncomfortable thing for me? And it's usually I'm going to get in trouble, or this person's going to be mad at me, or I'm going to look foolish, or whatever. And then I kind of just go through that and go, okay, I've gotten in trouble before. It's not great, but it's not that bad. I've been humiliated probably more times than I can even remember. It's not great, but here I am. It's fine. So that I don't let go of my objections. I discover that I don't actually have any objections at all. There's just no objection there. And so there's no resistance. So there's no discomfort. And then there's just me and not knowing. And then there's information gathering. And then there's oftentimes starting to piece together something very close to knowing. You know what I mean?
I do. I do. There are so many pieces to this. I was having a conversation with a client before you and I hopped on who was talking about humiliation. I feel like humiliation gets such a bad rap in our culture when it's the pathway to humility, which is such a beautiful quality, right? And when we look at humiliation, like, what's the issue? It's only my ego. Like, what has happened has already happened. Deciding to be humiliated after it happened is just because I have a self-image that isn't lining up with what actually just happened. So I encourage people to embrace the humiliation just as a means to connect us to humility in and of itself.
And for me personally, one of the things I noticed was that I was very embarrassed that people would see me being embarrassed. That was the big thing. So that something happens and you get embarrassed, okay, that's fine. But then someone says, oh, look, he's blushing, or oh my goodness, or something like that. And that was the real humiliating part for me. And so I think just I remember I had a couple of, I think I even mentioned this on the Here for the Truth podcast recently. I think I talk about this stuff in different places, and so I never know if I'm repeating myself in an acceptable interval or if it's like a super repeating. But
We'll call it acceptable.
good, thank you. I remember that I just was like, so, okay, whatever, here I am. I'm embarrassed, and I'm embarrassed of being embarrassed. Who cares? Like, this is just what it is. It's just what's happening. You know, I'm willing to be in this experiential situation right now, that there's nothing personal about it. And you know, what if I just allowed myself to go through this process instead of it being, oh my God, so, oh look, they can see me, and oh my God, they can tell. And there's the feeling of, you know, you imagine other people seeing you in the way that you imagine you look, and then there's a bad feeling that comes up, and you go, oh my God, there's that bad feeling. It's like, go ahead and do that and let that feeling be there. I'm like, oh yeah, there's that feeling that I feel when I imagine people seeing me in the negative way that I see myself. Here we go. Okay. And it's just a willingness, you know, to pass through that. Sort of, it seems like it demagnetizes you in some way, so that it doesn't happen nearly as often as it did when you had that kind of existential opposition to it.
Agreed. And I also think it has to, like, it's remembering that, like, most people don't care. Most people are so caught up in their own selves. I was at Ecstatic Dance a week ago wearing, like, kind of harem pants. And I jammed my finger in the pants and I pulled my own pants down and fell and, like, wasn't wearing underwear. And it was, like, so embarrassing. No one saw. No one saw. No one cared. But for, like, 5 seconds in my head, it was horrible. But, like, it was nothing. It was fine.
Yeah. And I think that willingness to experience vain emotions is very useful too. So that if you do find yourself embarrassed because of something, and you get caught up on it for a few minutes, I mean, you know, I like to say that I'm above being above anything. So I've ascended to the level beyond which it's necessary to have ascended to a level where you're above anything at all, so that you can be petty and you can be trifling and you can gossip and you can do whatever, or you can be inclined to. And listen, that's just the way that it is. I mean, you can share principles with people and then violate those principles. That's fine. Especially if you're not telling them they have to live that way. If you're just saying, here's something I've noticed works really well. Yeah. So you get over yourself, and then you get over the self that comes up as a result of the achievement of having gotten over yourself. And then there's just kind of a very non-achievement element to it. It's just sort of like being on vacation from bullshit, which is nice. And but I think that, by the way, is sort of what, if you want to distinguish real spiritual development from the trap or whatever, is that the real stuff doesn't feel like an achievement. It feels like I get another amount. I'm this much further removed from any kind of bullshit. I'm taking a bigger vacation from that nonsense and unnecessary suffering.
I like that. I like that. And I've seen, my own spiritual development, from my own a misguided understanding. I think I was aiming for some sort of imaginary perfection. And ultimately got to the place where, like, no, it's just opening my arms wide enough to hold all of my shadows with all of my gifts and let it all be fine the way it is. So, how much of what you're doing is based on language?
I mean, certainly language is the conduit, right? I mean, as I describe the principles to people, my thing is, okay, so you can use language for a couple of things. You can use language to help a person build sort of a model in their mind, which actually, incidentally, the NLP stuff, the first two books, The Structure of Magic, they were largely about linguistics and about how really adept therapists used language to basically to under they listened to the client, and they inferred from the language that the client used how the client organized and has sort of structured their model of reality, which then tells you something about where the buttons that you might want to push are. And so I like to use it to help people build understandings. Intellectual understandings, which can then be used as sort of a framework for organizing the little sensory impressions that you pick up as a result of practicing awareness in the moment. Just paying attention to what's going on in your environment, paying attention to what's going on within yourself, say as you're washing the dishes. Awareness work is very powerful. I think that it create, and I mean cultivating just that thing called awareness, where you notice what's going on and recognize it for what it is. The issue for a lot of people is that it's sort of abstract. And it's also very easy to think that you're aware when you're sort of not, or when you're sort of, you know, you can catch something that happened a second after it happened, but when it was actually happening, you weren't at all tuned into the fact it was going on. If a person has, then this is kind of what the Every Bit of Life course and awareness school and all that, sort of the point of it, one of them is to provide people with an intellectual framework that gives them little baskets that they can put the stuff that they pick up as a result of practicing awareness, they can put the stuff in, so it, you know, it, so that it becomes mutually reinforcing. And so that's the main thing. that I would use it for. And then also sometimes if you can say the right thing to the right person at the right time, you can just interrupt a pattern in a way that makes them laugh when they're ordinarily dour or serious. And even that is, it will provide them with sort of a personal experiential reference point. I can feel different than the way that I'm, that I almost always feel in this kind of situation.
Would you be willing to share one of the, you know, exercises or tools that you're helping people to put something in their awareness basket?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think. It's a little bit, it's such an organic kind of spontaneous process. I don't know how to offer it sort of that. So like one of the things we have is something called the life loop, and it's literally just something that I sort of made up slash stole from other people, right? And it's a 7-step process that basically allows you to categorize everything that's going on in your experience into one of 7 steps, right? And so like for instance, one of them is focusing. So, you know, what are you thinking about? And so as you go throughout your day, see, it's such a simple concept. People say, what am I thinking about? Okay, yeah, I get it. I can pay attention to what I'm thinking about. I don't need to do this or whatever. And it's like, I know you understand it, but there still is a permeative effect or a permeating effect that can be achieved as a result of taking something that's very easy to understand and also very easy to not do, which I think is one of the biggest challenges with this work. Is not that it's necessarily difficult or arduous or overwhelmingly challenging. It's that it's extremely easy to not do it because you hear an effective exercise described and some part of you is able to create a feeling that says, I have an idea about what I would get from doing that. So it's almost as if I've done it. So I'm done. And you create the feeling of done when you haven't even started. So you never start. And so that's one of the big advantages that I personally kind of, or excuse me, one of the big challenges I personally have to deal with, like in my own life. And so as you're going
through— Can you give us an example of that?
Paying attention to what you're thinking about. So let's say that you're going to set a timer to go off, you know, once an hour or 4 times an hour or whatever, and you're going to tune into what you're thinking about and you're going to write it down, right?
Okay.
That's not hard to do, but it's extremely easy to not do it. That just, if you want to test that, just try it. Just say tomorrow when I wake up, I'm going to set a time. Watch as your mind floods you with excuses to not do it. Watch as your mind conspires with your physical environment to flood you with excuses to not do it. Well, like I was getting anxious. Well, I'm sort of busy. Well, it's disturbing my partner. Well, it's just, there's all these, well, okay, I did it 3 times. I think I kind of understand where it's going. And there's this feeling inside that pretty much goes, yeah, you can probably quit now. Now it's good enough. You can stop.
And what is that? What do you attribute that to?
Oh, I call that sameness.
Sameness? Just our resistance to change?
That's interesting. Okay. So is sameness and resistance to change? I almost think of sameness as an entity. Not literally, not because I think it is, but because I think it helps me to kind of understand it. That there is, imagine that there is an entity called sameness that wants to just perpetuate, right?
Yep.
And it'll find, and it has a response to everything that tends towards the perpetuation of what is. So as an example, I try something and it works and I get the result I wanted, right? Talk to my partner in a different way. My partner's not angry at me. Start working out. My body starts feeling and looking the way I want it to, you know? Sameness has a response to those positive results that come as a result of a productive change in behavior that will tend you back towards sameness. And so a lot of the times it's, wow, I'm doing really great. I think what I'll do is I'll treat myself. Now, if what you're doing is actually treating yourself because you want to, that's fine. But if what you're doing is sort of derailing the progress that you've made because there's a sameness force within you, it's a little bit like a GPS in your car. Mm-hmm. So that like if you've got, I don't know, the grocery store kind of programmed in and you decide partway along the way, I don't want to take this route. I want to go to the mall first or something. And you don't update the coordinates. You just, of your own conscious volition, take a right when you're supposed to go straight. If you kind of check out and listen to a podcast again or get into a conversation with someone or even just get involved in your own internal dialogue, part of you will revert back to listening to the GPS. I mean, I will anyway. And then you'll end up driving to the grocery store. So that's kind of an example of that, the existential GPS, that perpetuating, like, and you can look at this. How do I respond when I fail, right? How do I respond when I succeed? How do I respond when I do well? How do I respond when I do poorly? And if you look at all those responses and say, what do these responses have in common? A lot of times what they have in common is the perpetuation of sameness. Or a return to sameness. If I do a good job, I say to myself, man, I would have been doing so much better if I would have started a month ago or a year ago. I've wasted so much time. And people will say that to themselves and they won't pay attention to the manner in which having said that to themselves affects how they feel now and what they're inclined to do moving forward. Because very often they'll straighten up and do something in a good way and they'll get a positive result. What it's like to be them will improve. And they're like, okay, improvement. hang on a second, how can I feel bad about the fact I just improved? Well, I could think about how much better it would have been had I started improving 6 months ago. Okay, now instead of feeling good, I feel bad. And instead of feeling motivated, I feel kind of like, well, it's probably too late. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. It's like, I mean, what's coming to mind as you're speaking, I'm thinking of Paul Levy's Wetiko, and I'm also thinking of Stephen Pressfield's The War of Art. There just seems to be this mechanism in us that likes to default to, I guess, what you're calling sameness, the bad habits, whatnot. Like, I notice it in myself where, like, I will make progress in creating a new pattern, and then the reward is like the bad habit, which makes no sense. But just noticing, like, are we all born with this sameness entity? Is it attracted to certain people for different reasons?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I just want to put in there as a reminder, it's just made up. Which is partly why it's so powerful, by the way. I mean, so when I say it's just made up, I'm saying it's important to remember that it's just made up, because then you'll understand how powerful it is, you know, which is a little sort of paradoxical, but I think also true. The thing I've noticed within myself, that there does at times, there seems to be a part of me that can become addicted to or attached to a specific iteration of sameness. Now, what I mean by that is eating chocolates, right?
Yep.
So if I always eat chocolates, right, then there's an element that the sameness is the fact that I'm doing what I always do. But there's also the content specific. What is it that I always do? It's chocolates, right? Chocolates is the thing. So there's a part of me that can get fixated on the chocolates. There's also a part of me, though, that just likes to do what I always do. And there's a part of me that just likes to do what I want to do by default. There's a part of me that maybe really likes what I'm inclined to do, but there's also a part that honestly just enjoys the flow of going with the inclination. And so what happens sometimes is that people, when they try to change a behavior, I think they declare war on both the part that is obsessed with the specific thing, as well as the part that doesn't really care. It just wants to do what it likes to normally do. My thing is, I like to have a dialogue with that part. I don't mean literally. What I mean is just through awareness, have an idea that says, listen, how much of me wants to do this just because this is the thing that is default to do, right? Because you know what we can do with a little effort? We can invest a little effort in sort of recalibrating the defaults. You know, we can engineer new inclinations and enjoy all of the pleasure and all of the ease of doing by default without the penalty of a negative content, right? Which was like overeating the chocolates. Like if we'll change what the default is, we can enjoy the ease and the lazy pleasure of doing default and also get a result that we want. And so that's one of the things for me, is that when I think about creating the change that I want in terms of making it easier, in terms of making life more pleasurable, in terms of experiencing or expending less effort in the long run, then all of a sudden my ears perk up. You mean I can make a little effort now in order to avoid making a long-term effort? And by effort, I don't even mean like burning calories. I'm talking about enduring unpleasant experiences. So if I can endure a little bit of an unpleasant experience now, and that'll free me from having to deal with unpleasant experiences moving forward, if I can build the capacity to experience physical exercise in a completely different way that is neutral, or that is perhaps even pleasurable. And so I can have a pleasurable experience of working out that leads to an even more pleasurable experience of having worked out, which is associated with an even super more pleasurable experience of being a person who is just sort of at the tail end of 3 years of consistent healthy exercise, then all of a sudden the lazy part of me is on my side. If I make it all about doing this workout now, there's a part of me that imagines that doing a good job, being productive, is always going to be as unpleasant as it is for me right now. And if I don't examine that assumption, I won't see how real it, or how wrong it is, and then it will never fall away. But if I can say to myself, no, when I'm signing up to work out forever, I'm actually really fundamentally learning to build a completely different experience of this productive activity, so that I can have fun, or you know, whatever you want to call it, enriching activity, this thing that is worth having done. And so, yeah, I've forgotten even what the question was, which is something that does happen. So
it's all good. It's something I notice in Western culture. I mean, I'm a Vipassana meditator. I've done several 10-day sits, fasting. Like, I recognize the benefits in being uncomfortable and learning, you know, to cultivate equanimity in those states. Do you notice a difference in whoever you're working with between, like, people who are born and raised in the United States, possibly having more inclinations towards pleasure, apathy, comfort, than people who are coming from other cultures?
Let's see. I don't feel strongly that there is no difference, but I don't know that I've observed a difference. Because I've got I've got people, you know, no, I don't think so. I mean, there very likely is one, but I think maybe the people that I'm getting to the point where I'm working with them, they're perhaps not indicative. They're not like a normal sample. You know, they're in many cases probably exceptional. And so when you're dealing with exceptional people from the different groups, a lot of the rules that might hold for the group as a whole maybe start to kind of deteriorate a little bit. I definitely think that there is. Part of me thinks that there's a sign there's that the culture sort of has as much to do with the manner in which the what do you call it, organic dysfunction manifests itself, rather than it's sort of like, okay, if I'm going to be sort of effed up and I'm in the West, what's being effed up going to look like? Oh, like this. Okay. And I go in that direction. And so it's more sort of the content versus the pattern. What I have noticed is that the further you go from content and the closer you get to pattern, the more similarities begin to emerge. Or let's say that the fewer groups there are to sort of put people in. Okay, so you're one of those. Okay, so you're one of those, right? And so things do streamline in that regard. The content's very distracting, but the patterns very often are pretty succinct. It's like getting close to the, I don't know, like the big river rather than the many little tributaries.
So I'm assuming the content it doesn't have much relevance. It's more the pattern that you're dealing with, and that's where you're seeing similarities among all your clients.
In general, the content is distracting. Sometimes you can do good work with content because sometimes the content will allow you to affect the pattern. I mean, for one thing, you need a little content in order for the person, you need the person to be able to talk about themselves in order for them to hear what you have to say. And so it's very useful to let the person whinge a little bit, you know what I mean? Or it to indulge the person in their desire for content because the mind, you know, it's like I don't know, if you want a child to eat a healthy vegetable, then you sort of offer them some fruit or dessert or something to that effect. That's not the perfect analogy, but like, I do think that the content is it's not irrelevant. It's just that it can become distracting and people can be a little addicted to it and people
Totally.
can flee to it in a way to avoid recognizing the pattern. And so one of the things for me is so for example, I'm complaining about the car dealership. I'm complaining about the person who cut me off in traffic. I'm complaining about my children. I'm complaining about my spouse. I'm complaining, complaining, complaining about, sp and then you could even take it down into even more specific content. Your spouse told you this and then they didn't do it. Your children don't under, you know what I mean? All this different stuff. And it's like, okay, what's the same in all of those different situations? I'm complaining. Usually I'm focused on what I don't want. I'm telling myself a story about what it means that they did that, which may or may not be true. I'm assigning meanings to all this different stuff. And one of the things for me is, you know, I'm not trying to take your content from you. So that if you'll just bear with me, right, and pay attention to these patterns here, I am not trying to trick you into having a realization that will prohibit you from being able to indulge in your content level pleasures, complaining. You can still complain, it's fine. So that's one of the things I spend a lot of time really persuading people. You can trust me. I'm not going to force you to improve or be a better person. That's not what this is about. It's about creating more options for you so that you can decide whether or not you're going to complain about people 24 hours a day, or if you're just going to do it every once in a while.
And is that, I mean, it's interesting that you chose complaining, right? Because and I see value and I'm guessing at what your work is, of course, in terms of like you don't have to like cling tighter to this binky because I'm not taking issue with that binky. But like in reality, is there any upside to complaining? Like in reality, are you holding the space for your client to ultimately realize the futility in complaining at all?
Well, I think one of the things that I do is I make a point of not knowing what's best for them. Not at the big picture level, right? I mean, with the exception of, I know it's going to be best for you if complaining is more of an option than it is right now. So let's turn it into an option. Let's turn it into a choice rather than a compulsion, and then let's make that choice more and more conscious. And then, and one of the things to me too is the more powerful the principle, the more important the principle, I think the more useful it is for you to violate it. Violate that principle and notice so that it become, rather than it becoming a principle, an external thing to which you're adhering, it will become a part of your nature if you really allow yourself, right, to violate, disrespect that principle, discard that principle. you know, and with full awareness, that's what I'm doing. And no judgment and no condemnation and no resistance, and really to purge yourself of the notion that these are things that you should do. Because I've noticed that when people say these are things that I should do, you're setting up within yourself an inclination to do other things. And that's an activity. That's a strategy, right? Versus integrating it into your nature. And so I think when you learn about a principle like this, sometimes violation of the principle is an aspect of really fully integrating it, because you get it past that outside part that says, oh, here's the rules that I follow. And you begin not to know about how futile it is to complain, but you experience the futility of complaining. To experience the futility of complaining is usually, I think, to be disinclined to do the behavior at all. And then you're really free from it. Because if all you're doing is not complaining because you know it's futile, but you still feel like you'd like to me, that's not fully free of the pattern. The full freedom is where I'm just not inclined to do that any longer.
So it feels like there's like a deliberate intention to not demonize or problemize mm-hmm. any strategies or content, but instead mm-hmm. to expand the array of strategies, again, without any demonization, and allowing that person to exist in choice instead of with some sort of inner punisher that's like, I shouldn't do this, I'm bad, I ate cake today. Like, to just take it, expand more into the realms of choice. And then from that vantage point, people can determine through their own experience if that choice is still serving them. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's accurate, unless the person is familiar with stuff like that, in which case I will demonize the thing there because the system knows how to handle it. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
But in general, I mean, most people seem to have had experiences with authority figures, parents, teachers, things like that, where they go, you know, and then the person goes, oh, yeah, I really should, or oh, I better, or else I'll get in trouble. And that's how it's like a little petri dish that cultivates the disinclination or the inclination to do things that are different. And my thing is, like, I'm not going to play that game with you.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what you should do, not because I want you to go do it. I'm going to tell you what I think you should do so that I can then, so that one, do you agree that you should do that? Yes, you do. Okay, great. All right, now let's see what happens. And let's see what happens when you agree that that's what you should do. Let's watch. And then let's see what you do when that thing happens and how you respond to that. And so it really is kind of a case, but there's not like the rule is figure out what the sameness part of the person knows how to handle and then give them something else. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Interesting. And you mentioned that most of the people who come to you are exceptional. So I'm curious to know who you're working with, why you're drawn to work with certain people, and why people are drawn to you. Like, who are you magnetizing?
I don't know. I have no idea who they, but I do know that there. You have to have something kind of wrong with you to watch one of my videos and then go, I want 10 weeks of that guy for, you know, 4 hours of meeting. That there's a certain, I don't know what it is. I think one of the things is that it's people who have spent a certain amount of time in this world, the personal growth, spiritual development world, and they're, I want to say dissatisfied with the dearth of content, but they are dissatisfied with what they perceive to be the dearth of content, or a lot of kind of superfluous information that doesn't necessarily. So what I've noticed is that personal spiritual development stuff can be one of two things. It can be, and probably the third thing would be a combination of the two. It can be like a hobby, which is to go like, I'm going to go to the basket weaving class. I'm going to go do personal growth stuff now. And it's enriching in the same way that going to the book club would be enriching. It's like a thing in and of itself. Going to the book club doesn't necessarily change your marriage life. It doesn't necessarily change your life with your children, except in as much as taking self-care time or whatever might, you know, cause you to behave differently. But you're not, it's, you know, like, it's not taking the car to the mechanic. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of a different thing. So there's that. Then there is the kind of thing where it's like, listen, I don't really like personal growth stuff, but what I do like is I like to live more effectively. I like to live more efficiently in the sense that, like, I like for each unit of experience to be more worth having than it has been. And so I'm trying to get in here, get some information, and get out of here as quickly as possible. And I personally think that my favorite kind of person is someone whose relationship to personal growth is a little bit like going into a store that you hate that has one thing that you really need. that you're just like, listen. And actually, when I was like little, you know, I want to go to the toy aisle and things like that. And sometimes someone would go, listen here, we're not going to look at the toys. We're going straight to this. We're getting this and we're getting out. We don't have time. That I think is the perfect attitude to have towards personal growth. And so we either have people who are reach that place because they've done everything, or we have people who reach that place because they've never done anything because they don't like the personal growth stuff. The hardest people to work with are what I call like the personal growth junkies. I think that's a Bill Harris term, actually, because they're so saturated with a certain amount of understanding of concepts that if you use words that they're familiar with, a huge parts of their mind just shut off.
Mm-hmm.
And they cannot help but flood their system with the sense that they know what you're talking about, they know where you're going, and they know that it won't work for them because they've tried it before and all that. So those are the kind of the tough cases to work with.
And who, like, what drives you? Why do you do this? How does this tie into your purpose?
I often wonder about that. I mean, I like to, I enjoy figuring out how to help a person understand things.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like a puzzle to me. It feels like a Rubik's cube. It feels like, so here's the information, here's the information system, here are the concentric rings of defense that this information system has in order to keep this information from getting in. What shape does the information have to take to get in, and where does it have to go in order to take root and generalize outward? How is this person going to misunderstand this? How is this person going to understand it, but find a way to kind of contain the positive change impacts it's going to have for them? Those are all interesting things for me. It's very much a kind of, I don't know if it's unconscious, but like, you know, it's very much a kind of like I let a part of myself take over and do the interacting with people. So it's very natural. I don't have a tremendous native desire to help people, which is a strange, you know, kind of thing. I don't mean that, like, if I see someone in difficulty, then my inclination is to go help them. But I don't like at the end of the day say, oh my gosh, I've helped this person and that person. Oh, I just want to help so many more people. That's just not there for me. This, for some people, I know what it is, and I think that's a very nice thing. But it's wonderful for me when I see someone doing well and I see someone getting the principles and I see someone enjoying the benefits and all that. But that philanthropic drive has never been what it is for me. It's just more kind of like, you're feeling this way. You don't want to feel this way. I know it's possible for you to feel different. You want to work together and see if we can't make that happen. It's kind of that sort of thing.
I feel that. And I mean no disrespect in saying that. And I remember when you were speaking, well, it was actually when Melissa was speaking during your talk, and she was sharing the story of you saying you don't have to do that, which has been a total life changer for me. And I'm running that through my mind. But I also had the thought when she said that, like, it would be terrifying to date this person. Like, she's got to have so much courage, because it just seems like you're seeing everything all the time and you're going to be calling the people around you. Yeah. On their bullshit,
right,
it seemed a little intimidating.
Yeah. Well, remember before when you asked me what makes you different, what makes you weird? It's all you knew. And the thing about that, though, is that my perspective is, if I have an intuition about what I think the person I'm talking to might be doing, I might be wrong about that. And I think, honestly, the secret to being right a lot of the time is always being aware of the possibility that you're wrong. And having that not be a problem. So it's not self-doubt, but it's also not self-certainty. It's you know, I don't know if you call that, what do you call that? Situational agnosticism. So you say, you know, it's just kind of like, here's what seems to be going on right now. What do you think about that? And so, yeah, I mean, would I want to date me? I don't know. I'm probably not so bad. but like, it's, we have a really nice time together outside of this stuff. And that's like because my understanding of this stuff is, you're not supposed to sit around and talk about this crap all the time with your partner. You're supposed to be silly. And that's what I like to do. And in fact, most of my ability, or most of my like fascination, fixation, compulsion with regard to this stuff, I think arose as a result of when I was a child, I wanted to be silly. I wanted to have fun. And I was surrounded by people who would snap me out of that and bring me into their nonsense and into their tension and into their just ritualistic problem having.
That does it for the first half of my conversation with Stephen Ravenstog. As you are inspired to pick up the second half of our super juicy exchange, you can do that over on my Patreon and my Locals communities. Those addresses are dannykatz.locals.com. and patreon.com/DannyKatz. At both of those communities, for as little as $5 a month, you get access to all of my second half conversations, plus post-show throwdowns, bonus content, lots of juicy benefits, including the knowingness that you are supporting a content creator whose work you like enough to tune into. It is your support that allows me to keep on keeping on. So thank you for joining me on either the Patreon or Locals or both, because and rocks. I'm also reminding you once again to sign up for my newsletter at DannyKatz.com and urging you to register immediately for my pop propaganda media literacy course for teens and grownups alike. This is the course that I created for my homeschool teens while the FOVIDOP was in full effect. Based on mucho lots of requests and demand, I ultimately digitized the course. It is appropriate for teens and grownups alike. It is your surefire way to safeguard yourself, your teens, your loved ones from propaganda, media manipulation, and groupthink, while at the same time building your critical thinking, your self-esteem, confidence, and agency. It's super fun. It's super chock full. It's 11 modules. It's available now on poppropaganda.com. You can also get through my website, DannyKatz.com. Run, don't walk, to register immediately. That does it. Thank you so much for sharing your sacred attention with me. Thank you for remembering that every word matters, that you are omniscopic amazingness. I will see you over on the Locals and the Patreons. Have a rockin' day.